Hello, everyone. This is the Midwestern Archaeology Podcast, and I'm Lee Strange. Today, we're joined by Dr. Michael Strazewski, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Southern Indiana and Director of the Endeavor Awards Program. Much of his recent work has focused on the Mann Site in southwestern Indiana, a massive and mysterious middle woodland center dating between 200 and 600 CE. Covering more than 600 acres, the site is home to geometric earthworks, platform and burial mounds, and evidence of a large resident population. In his new book, The Mann Phase, Hopewell Culture in Southwestern Indiana, Dr. Strazewski draws on over a decade of research and longer to reveal how the Mann Phase, both connected to the wider Hopewell world and forged a distinct cultural identity of its own. Today, we'll explore what makes the Mann Site so significant, what its artifacts and earthworks tell about the Hopewell traditions, and how new discoveries are shaping our understanding of ancient life in the Midwest. Dr. Strazewski, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Just am curious about your own personal and professional journey with archaeology. So how did you first get involved in the field?
Oh, well, I'd always been interested in old things, I suppose, right? When I was a kid, you know, people had asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I, at that time, said paleontologist because I was interested in fossils and all that sort of thing. And, you know, when I went to college, I was actually a psychology major and I got a degree in psychology. Mm. And, you know, my problem was I was always interested in so many different things that I had a hard time not narrowing down where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I got a degree in psychology and then I thought, okay, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to go into psychology? Maybe not, you know? So I said, okay, well, I like old stuff. I like history. Yeah, I'm going to try archaeology. Sure, why not? You know? And so not knowing much about what I was getting into, I started down that path in graduate school. And, you know, I suppose things worked out for me. And I wound up with a job that I like going to, which I suppose is everybody's goal, right? You know, you don't want to have
absolutely
a job that you dislike for the rest of your career. So everything worked out pretty well for me.
That's awesome. Was there something, an experience that you had with an ancient culture or a movie that you watched that kind of first piqued your interest in archaeology?
You know, we always used, my parents were both interested in history too. And, you know, we would go to historic sites and museums and that sort of thing. So I was always kind of steeped in that sort of stuff. And sort of a natural outgrowth of you know, my youth.
Gotcha.
To get into learning about ancient peoples.
Gotcha. So yeah, I'm not curious. So once you got into archaeology, how long did it take for you to become aware of the Mann Site? And when did you start work and research on the site?
Yeah, the site, I mean, I went to graduate, I did my PhD at IU in Bloomington, Indiana University. And it was always this site that we knew about, you know, the Mann Site. It was this kind of like fantastic site that was down there in southern Indiana, a couple hours away. And it was this like forbidden fruit that nobody had, you know, was able to do any kind of work on and that sort of. And, you know, when I came to University of Southern Indiana, back in 2006, I inherited, you know, the collections that were here. And amongst that stuff was a large collection of materials from the Mann Site that had been donated to the university some years earlier. It was a collector's type thing, but it was a lot of stuff. And nobody had really looked at it. And it wasn't even really all that well cataloged. And I said, you know, my first foray, let's say, into the Mann Site was dealing with that big collection and getting familiar with the type of stuff that was coming off of the site. So yeah, like I said, that started it. And then I had an opportunity some years later to do some magnetometry survey there. There had been a large magnetometry survey done previously by a guy, Stefan Peterson. It provided some really like intriguing results, like what is exactly beneath the surface at this site. And so when I got a chance to go out there again with some new land purchases that had happened, I jumped on that opportunity and enlisted my friends to help me. I said, hey, you want to work at the man site? And people said, yeah, I'd love to. So we got a number of people to go out there and knock out a big magnetometry survey out there. So when we added all that information together, it was really amazing results. I mean, stuff that I had never seen before. And so after that point, you know, I really started to get serious about doing something with it. And eventually decided I had enough material in hand that I could get a book out of it instead of going to piece it out into smaller articles. I said, let's just try to do it all in one fell swoop, or the vast majority of it, at least, in one fell swoop and write a book on the topic.
Thank you. And I have to say, I've really enjoyed reading it. So you did a great job with the book. So with that being said, before we discuss the Hopewell man, the man phase, I was wondering if you could give us an idea about who the Hopewell are before we get into a regional subset of them. So they are notoriously difficult to define. They're widespread, diverse, and obviously not a single unified culture. So if you could just give us an understanding of what that term means, what archaeologists mean when they say Hopewell.
Yeah, that would have been my first comment about the Hopewell is notoriously difficult to define. I mean, it's one of those things that you know it when you see it, but it's, when you try to nail it down, it's a little slippery. But, most people would agree, I think, today that the Hopewell is really a common sort of ceremonial outlook on life. I suppose you might say there's a lot of similar kind of goods that were used for ceremonial purposes and fancy things that are made out of exotic materials, similarity in burial practices, similarity in earthwork types across a broad area of, I guess, centered on the Ohio River Valley and into Illinois, but spreading out from there. There are, Hopewell looking things a considerable distance from that. But when you get down to the village level and you start looking at the pottery and just the sort of nitty gritty of everyday Hopewell life, it starts to fracture a little bit and you're not seeing as many commonalities there. But yeah, it's one of those things that people have been trying to tackle for a long time.
Yeah. And anyone that's talks about the quote unquote Hopewell people as if they were just a single person or a single people group, probably doesn't have a full understanding of at least the term itself. A lot of people use the word Hopewell, at least where we are in ARI, Lawrenceburg. People use it kind of just as a general term for the Ohio Hopewell. So the people that were responsible for the geometric earthworks. But yeah, that's a term that is used for a lot of different places in Eastern America.
The most, I guess, complex version of Hopewell is Ohio Hopewell. So like most of the time when people do say Hopewell, they think of Ohio, but there's a lot of Hopewell stuff going on elsewhere. Definitely.
Want to get more involved in local archaeology? At ARI, we identify, preserve, and responsibly explore archaeological sites in Southeast Indiana, Southwestern Ohio, and Northern Kentucky. Our volunteers are one of the driving forces behind this mission, from participating in archaeological digs, assisting in lab work, artifact processing, and supporting field trips and fundraising. Every role helps us move forward. With just a one-hour training, you'll gain new skills, meet new people, enjoy nature, and make a real impact. Volunteering with ARI means joining a community passionate about history and preserving it for generations to come. Join us at ARI, be a part of history, be a part of the future.
So with that being said, the Hopewell man, they're at an interesting confluence. So can you tell us how the man phase fits into our understanding of the greater kind of context of the Hopewell world and where it's geographically situated? Because I feel like that might give us a better idea about what you see materially at the man site.
Yeah, it's okay. So you've got this kind of Hopewell phenomenon, like I said, the most people think of where it was the most sort of complex, et cetera, centered on Ohio, southern portion of Ohio, and that chunk of the Ohio River Valley. And then there was a second Hopewell sort of hot spot in Illinois River Valley in that area. The Manface Hopewell stuff is kind of in between the two, geographically, at least. But the other thing to point out, too, is that when you look at the chronology, Manface Hopewell doesn't sync up 100% with those two Hopewell phenomena. I mean, the Illinois Hopewell stuff is it kind of is petering out by 200, 250 AD, whereas the Ohio Hopewell stuff starts to peter out by 400, 450 AD, and Manface stuff doesn't start until 200. So it starts like after Ohio or the Illinois stuff is already going sort of downhill, and towards the tail end of the Ohio Hopewell, and Manface continues through 600. Now, most people in this area of the Midwest, you know, that's firmly in, you know, late woodland territory. You're out of the Hopewell by that point in time. But we've got quite a few dates from sites that are getting into as late as AD 600, where you've got something that's still recognizably Hopewell as far as material culture is concerned. And so not only is it distinct geographically, it's also, you know, it doesn't sync up perfectly chronologically either with the rest of the Hopewell area. So it kind of hangs on as a Hopewell thing past the point it's already kind of wrapping up elsewhere, at least in the Midwest.
And I'm curious, based off of where it's located, so it is kind of sandwiched between the Illinois Hopewell and the Ohio Hopewell, maybe not sandwiched, but it's between them. Where do you think that, we'll talk more about the Southeastern influences later in the interview, but I'm curious, what facilitates that cultural contact between the Hopewell world and the Southeast? Is it the Ohio River? Is it that riverine network? I know it might be hard to say, but is there kind of an explanation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it has a lot to do with that. You know, the place where Manface is situated is at the southeastern tip, or southwestern tip of Indiana, essentially where the Ohio and Wabash River confluence is located. But you've got a number of other rivers, you know, coming into that area, not directly next door to the man site, but you've got the Tennessee and Cumberland rivers, which are connecting you literally to the southeast. So it would have been a short, you know, hop, skip, and a jump, I suppose, from those confluences up to the man site. So there's a lot of rivers kind of coming together in and around that area. So I don't find it terribly surprising that there is some kind of a southeastern connection to the man site. But yeah, I mean, exactly why that happened 100%, I don't know, but there are certainly routes that connect up those areas for sure.
Well, it's definitely an intriguing mix of at least material culture. We can only guess at what the beliefs or languages, what that might have looked like when they were actually alive. So now that we kind of have an understanding of the Hopewell, the Manface culture, let's kind of take our, like, zoom in on the man site itself, because that's where it's the eponymous site. Could you give us a brief introduction into the history of the site and some of the unique circumstances that the site has presented to your research? Because it's not like other major Hopewell centers that might be publicly owned or things like that.
Right. Yeah, it does have a very different history than, let's say, for example, Ohio, which many people would be familiar with. I mean, the site was visited, or it wasn't really even recognized to the greater archaeological community, such as it was, you know, in the 19th century, until later. And, you know, the first excavations that we know of that took place there were in the late 19th century by a guy named Joel Hyatt. And he was just a, you know, he wasn't, you know, part of the archaeological community. He was just a guy. He worked at the school district or something, just says excavation. But he wrote some things down, you know, recorded what he found, maybe as best as people did at that time. But that, you know, and then there was a lot of collecting and digging in the mounds, as, you know, as you might expect throughout that time period. But it really, the site really wasn't brought to the attention of the archaeological community until 1935, when Glenn Black was informed of its existence by some local collector people. He was shown some of the pottery there, and he said, wow, this is pretty interesting, odd stuff. I mean, it doesn't seem to belong in this area, some of the materials that were coming off of the site. And I think, you know, perhaps at some point he did intend to go back, but he never did do any kind of research there. So at least it was on the archaeological radar. But so there was a guy named Jack Householder, who was an amateur archaeology person. He did a flyover of the site in 1950 and took some aerial photos. And that's when the geometric earthworks were first recognized. So prior to that, I don't think anybody had reported that they even existed. They were already plowed down and heavily impacted by, you know, erosion, et cetera. So they weren't super apparent from the surface, but you could see them. You could definitely see them from the air. So that was the first time those were recognized. And kind of the next kind of big thing that happened at the Mann site was amateur archaeologist named Charles Laser made a huge number of trips out there, and he was just really dedicated to the Mann site. And part of the reason is because the site was being threatened from development. You know, it's close to the Ohio River. You know, people wanted to put this thing in there, a coal gasification plant and some other stuff that they wanted to do. And Laser kind of saw the site as in danger of being imminently destroyed. And so I think he felt a duty to go out there and collect information about it before that happened. Now, luckily those projects didn't come to fruition and the site is still with us, but he was out there for about 25 years, and I counted up. He has a log of how many times he went to the site. He went to the site 511 times in 25
years. Oh my gosh.
Calculating that, I sat down, did the math. He made a trip, like one trip, like every 2 weeks for 20 years to the site.
Oh my goodness.
He was out there and he picked up all sorts of things from the site. You know, he had permission to be on a certain chunk of it, so he didn't walk over the whole thing. But he picked up lots of stuff. And the great thing about Laser's collections is that he didn't buy things, he didn't sell things, number one. So like a lot of collectors, you know, they're trading artifacts back and forth and this kind of thing. He did not do that. And number two, he picked up basically everything. So he didn't, you know, collectors are interested in like the goodies. They want the nice spear points and beads and that kind of stuff. And he would pick up like little busted biface pieces and mundane pieces of pottery and stuff off the surface. So it's a really nice representative collection of what was at the site, not just the goodies and not just, you know, cherry picking all the best stuff and leaving the rest of it behind. So he did. Here's another indication of how much stuff he picked up from the site. There's 60 pounds of lamellar blades from that site that he picked up. So it's like,
oh my gosh.
But yeah, so I mean, recognizing the importance of that collection, it was purchased by the Indiana State Museum some years ago. So that's kind of the next step. And then what happened too, then the only professional excavations that have been done at Mann were done by Jim Keller at IU Bloomington. And he was out there for four seasons from like the mid 60s. The last season he did was in 77. I mean, he excavated quite a bit, including a lot of features. But the downside was that he never wrote it up real well. I mean, there was like a small chapter in a book that sort of summarizes what he did. But other than that, there was no comprehensive write-up of the materials that they found or the features or anything like that. And so after Keller's work, the site was sort of shut down by the landowners. Yeah. So there was a whole bunch of landowners at this site because it was divided up into a whole bunch of strips, just kind of historical circumstances. And what happened was the landowners were getting just sick of people trespassing, because you had a lot of collectors out there looting the site and going out there without landowner permission, digging holes in their fields and stuff like that. And eventually, you know, those people that owned the site said, all right, enough of this. You know, we've had it with all this digging and, you know, people not even asking to be out there, et cetera. And they just shut it down. Like, nobody is allowed out there at all. And that's kind of why, you know, I kind of mentioned at the beginning that the site was almost this, you know, forbidden fruit that nobody was allowed on. And that's the reason was because the landowners were just not interested in anybody doing anything out there. Archaeologists, collectors, nobody, right? And so what happened then was Stefan Peterson, who I'd mentioned, who I mentioned previously, he, you know, decided like, hey, you know what? I'm going to see if I can possibly, you know, it's been 25 years or something, you know, let's see if I can get permission to do some survey work. You know, we're not going to dig holes. We're not going to pick up artifacts. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to walk over the site with a magnetometer and collect data. And he managed to get permission from a number of the landowners and collected this data. Like I said, that it was just fantastic magnetometry data that give us a first real glimpse as to what's beneath the surface in any kind of broad sense. And that's, you know, kind of leads us up to the present day. What's been happening with the site is the state has been buying up chunks here and there.
That's been,
you know, come up for sale, and the state has the money at the time. You know, when those two things, you know, kind of coincide, then the state has been actively kind of pursuing purchasing pieces of the site with the recognition that it's probably one of the, I'm going to say not probably, it is one of the most important sites in the state of Indiana for sure. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a shame that after all of that, the history of the site, like post-contact, it's basically just been under agriculture and just being eroded since then. I was curious, do you know, are there any colonial era descriptions of the site or any in any kind of written like travel accounts of it at all?
I don't know of anything prior to Hyatt's descriptions in the late 19th century. I mean, if they're out there, I haven't run across them. But yeah, so it was kind of recognized relatively late compared to a lot of the Ohio stuff, which was recorded by, you know, people like Squire and Davis and that sort of thing in the earlier 19th century. So
Okay, so with being said, could you give us an understanding of the layout of the man site itself? So how many acres are we talking? I understand that there's earthworks and other kind of features. Could you just give us a spatial kind of description?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking at least a couple hundred acres. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. It's huge. Let's just say that it would take you probably 20 minutes to walk from one end to the other east-west direction. It's, so you've got kind of three different zones, let's say, of the site. On the far western edge is where the geometric earthworks are. So you have a big, I guess it's, you call it a rectangular earthwork that abuts the edge of the terrace, and a square earthwork just to the north of that. And in the center of the big rectangular one is a huge kind of loaf-shaped mound. And that portion of the site really hasn't been investigated much at all. Like I said, we know what the earthworks, the extent from aerial photos and that sort of thing, but there really hasn't been much done other than that. I'd like to, you know, do some more work in there in that part of the site in the future, but you know, I had to get the book written and get it out, and perhaps sometime we can add to that, but at the present time not.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the western part of the site. So the central part of the site is, I mean, I kind of call that downtown man site for lack of a better term, but there's a couple platform mounds there. There are some smaller geometric earthworks there. And there's kind of an open area that is like a plaza type thing where there's not a whole lot of features in that area. So it looked like it was kind of intentionally kept free from habitation. So that I'm assuming, you know, from the data that we have, that that was kind of the main ceremonial area of the site. And directly abutting that to the east is the habitation area. It's this massive area of human habitation. I mean, you look at the magnetometry data and there's literally thousands of features covering a very, very wide area. on there's habitation on the upper terrace, and then there's some habitation on the lower terrace adjacent to that. And so we don't know the full extent of that because not all of it's been surveyed, although we do have a pretty good notion of where that material is beneath the surface. And then when you get to the eastern edge of the site, there's a number of like conical burial mounds. Mm. And connecting the downtown area to the burial mounds is a linear earthwork that extends for over 700 meters to the burial mound area. And so I think there's five or six burial mounds out on that eastern edge of the site. But yeah, it's a monster. It's a really big site. So
yeah, well, it's just so interesting how that compares to the other major Hopewell centers that we all know about. So like the Newark earthworks, it just seems super unique. But that's getting a little bit ahead of ourselves with the habitation stuff. So I wanted to ask you about the platform mounds because that on the site is particularly interesting, just given how rare they are, it seems, in the Midwest at this time. So do we know anything about how the people of the band site may have utilized these platform mounds, and if there is any evidence of there being any kind of structures or any sort of, I'm just curious what you have found regarding the platform mounds.
Yeah, so basically with platform mounds, just to kind of frame it, you know, the Middle Woodland platform mounds are not really a thing in, you know, the Midwest. For a long time, it was assumed that those platform mounds at the man site were Mississippian, because that's what we'd expect around, you know. And there is a Mississippian component at man, too. There's a Angel Phase Mississippian, and there's what we call Cabern-Welburn Mississippian there as well. It's you know, minor compared to the Middle Woodland stuff. But so, yeah, like I said, it was assumed that they were Mississippian for quite some time. And actually, Charlie Lacer, that collector that I was talking about, he did some excavations in one of the platform mounds and found nothing but Hopewell stuff. So we have some, you know, it was suspected, of course, that they were Hopewell. But his excavations kind of confirmed that fact that it is not Mississippian at all. So yeah, that's kind of just to establish the fact that they aren't Mississippian mounds. We know that for sure. But yeah, the platform mounds, Middle Woodland or Hopewell era platform mounds are a southeastern thing, particularly in more the deeper south, let's say. Closest ones to southeast or southwest Indiana would be in Tennessee. And then there's few of them in Ohio, Hopewell. There's some with the Cedar Bank, Newark, and Marietta that have been identified mostly from like Squire and Davis maps from the early 19th century. And then that's it. You know, north of the Ohio River, there are no other examples. So they're weird. They're unique. They don't belong there, essentially. So what's on top of the mounds? Well, that was something that we answered with the magnetometry survey. There have been excavations in platform mounds, Middle Woodland platform mounds before. And typically what you're going to find in those mounds from in the southeast is post holes, burned areas, a lot of sort of mundane looking debris, you know, potsherds, stone tools, and animal remains and stuff like that. And so there's not a real clear idea as to what's happening on top of these mounds. Sometimes you'll find like a row of posts suggesting a wall perhaps, or a fence of some kind, but you know, it's not like anything is just like jumping out at you like, you know, this is exactly what's going on there. So when we did the magnetometry survey at Mann, we were super surprised to see very clear outline of what I'm calling post enclosures. Basically square, rectangular, and circular post outlines showing just there's basically two of them. There's one on the east and one on the west of IU-8, which is the bigger platform mount. And these are just enclosures that are run from north to south, kind of in a linear fashion, with the features in the enclosures sort of mirror image one another. So you can kind of draw a line right down the middle of this series of post enclosures, and the features are sort of mirror imaged. You can see like a heat related feature or a thermal feature, and there's a corresponding thermal feature on the other side, on the east and the west sides, and they're huge. I mean, okay, just to kind of give you some perspective, IU9, the biggest of the platform mounds, is about 140 meters long, and the post enclosures are almost as long as that, and on the summit of the mound.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then there's another one, like the eastern post enclosure is a large circle accompanied by a square. And then the circle has a huge thermal feature on the inside, on the interior in the center of the circle. And then there's like spoke like features coming out from the center of that. Now that we haven't done any excavations on the mound, and there's no immediate plans to do anything like that, but it was about the clearest magnetometry results and the most, I guess, spectacular magnetometry results I've ever had. I mean, I've done a fair amount of magnetometry in my day, and it was just like, you know, when we downloaded this and processed it, you know, I was kind of blown away by it because it was so clear, so amazing as to what was on this thing, you know. So it gave us a really clear picture. Now, like I said, there's not really any kind of corresponding similar thing that's been identified on platform mounds in the southeast. I mean, I don't know, perhaps the people at the man site were taking this platform mound idea, hey, let's build a platform mound and we'll put some stuff on top of it, right? But they were doing it in their own sort of unique way, maybe.
Right.
But, you know, I kind of envision a platform mound with a whole bunch of posts up on top and all sorts of activities happening, ceremonial activities, many of which are involving fires, sometimes intense fires. Sometimes these post enclosure areas might have been shielded from view from the general public. But yeah, and a lot of things like destruction of artifacts too, burning of artifacts. And like there was a whole bunch of thousands of fragments of bone tubes. Bird bone tubes, which were engraved with various little Hopewell motifs that were burned, and they're just completely calcined and burned down to little pieces. Things that were lead artifacts at one time that are now little kind of droplets of lead that have been completely burned, along with more things that just seem kind of like mundane, everyday sorts of artifacts, just potsherds and stone tool fragments and animal remains and stuff like that. So, you know, it's not 100% clear what's going on up there, but it involves burning things, sometimes fancy stuff, and sometimes things that seem to be more ordinary type things. Some kind of like a feast, perhaps, up there on top of the mound.
Right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fascinating. You mentioned the bone tubes that are kind of impressed with effigies or motifs. Is that just a common Hopewell artifact that you find in these kind of contexts, or is it something unique to man?
I did run across a very similar thing with burned bird bone tubes that is reported, and I can't remember the reference now off the top of my head, but it was reported these were associated with one of the mounds at the Hopewell site. So there's that similarity there, but yeah, they're definitely Hopewell type artifacts for sure.
It's so interesting that you have this, what you were just saying about this kind of southeastern idea of a platform mound with almost like a Hopewell fusion, that it's just really cool. Reading about the site.
Yeah. It is fascinating. It was a lot of work to try to sort all this stuff out, I could tell you that.
I'm sure.
You're trying to deal with Hopewell, not just in Ohio or not just in Illinois, but you're trying to big picture of like Hopewell in the very, very broad sense and trying to make some connections there. But yeah, I mean, so you've got a platform mound, which is a very southeastern thing, but on top of the platform mound is a circle and a square adjacent to one another, which you see in Ohio Hopewell, albeit on a much larger scale. You know, you'll see it in a number of Hopewell sites in Ohio. Big geometric earthworks where you got a circle adjacent to a square or an octagon. You see that kind of that Ohio idea on top of a platform mound at man site.
That's super interesting. So now I'm curious about the geometric features, the geometric earthworks that are found at the man site. So how do these compare to, because the geometric earthworks are often associated with Ohio Hopewell sites. Sure. So how do these features compare to the earthworks that are found more east in Ohio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, there was like two sort of squares. One of them is more kind of like a rectangle. Like I said, it's a partial square mm-hmm. that opens up to the south, to the edge of the terrace. You do see that kind of thing where earthworks opening up to a change in elevation at some mm-hmm. sites, not necessarily Ohio, but, and then the smaller square is basically identical to something you might find in Ohio. Same size. It's got the open corners and there's actually some openings at the midpoints as well. You know, I would love to do magnetometry and those to see exactly what's going on there, but we haven't had the opportunity to do it yet. But yeah, the geometric earthworks are quite similar to something you would see in Ohio, and there's also actually another one. It's called IU4, which seems to be a partial geometric earthwork. Mm. There's little segments that are visible on the aerial photos, but mm-hmm. it may not have been finished or something like that. We're not entirely sure, you know, if it got interrupted midstream. But yeah, so there's a lot going on over there that we don't know about.
Whether you're 8 or 80, there's something for everyone at the Archaeological Research Institute. Join a kids' dig, take an immersive tour, learn ancient skills in our experimental lab, or try our virtual reality experiences. ARI makes archaeology accessible, hands-on, and fun for all ages. Come play in the dirt, or just watch others do it. Find programs at exploreari.org. Is the scale of those earthworks comparable? Are they average size? Are they a little bit smaller or larger?
It's absolutely comparable. Yeah. Mm. The smaller square is about the same size as the ones you'd find in Ohio. And actually the larger square, if you took it and made it into a whole square, it would be just about four times as large as the smaller square. So you could fit four of those little squares inside the larger square. And then there's a huge mound in the center of that larger square, the partial one. It's called IU1. And I had an opportunity to walk on it a couple of years ago for the first time. And it is absolutely massive. I mean, it is, and it has really? Woods too. So it hasn't been impacted to any, to as much, as great an extent as the rest of the site or many of the, let's say, Ohio Hopewell mounds. It's still in pretty good shape, but it's massive. It's kind of a loaf-shaped mound, you might call it, but similar to ones that you would find in Ohio, like Harness Mound or something like that. You know, there's a number of them that have been excavated over the past, you know, couple hundred years or so. But yeah, it's a huge mound. You know, it's hard to believe that it's constructed by people because it's so, you know, it would have been a monster undertaking.
Yeah, that's I wish I could see a picture of it or at least get something for the scale, but
it's really it's in woods, you know, so it's like I was trying to take pictures of it and you really can't capture it because it's like covered in woods, and so you just keep walking and there's more mound and more mound and more mound, but it's kind of hard to appreciate it unless you're really on the ground.
So taken all together, all of these features seems like it would be in the man site heyday, they would have been quite expansive and extensive and also more than enough to suit the needs of the local inhabitants. Possibly, it wouldn't be hard to imagine that, you know, not you didn't just have people participating at the site that lived there, but maybe people kind of from the other man phase sites coming to this central location to participate in these, which would match up pretty, from what I understand of the Hopewell, would match up to specifically the Ohio Hopewell, kind of how they laid out their habitations. So speaking of that, I did want to move over to a discussion about the habitation of the site, because in your book, you noted that there are a large amount of habitation-like debris that's distributed close to the site's earthwork and just all across the site as being one of the most unusual attributes of the man site. So can you explain why this is unusual for a Hopewell-associated site specifically?
Yeah. I mean, if you can contrast it to Ohio Hopewell, you know, you got these big earthworks, and there might be some evidence of maybe temporary habitation nearby that, you know, that used in the fabrication of exotic goods or something involved in the ceremonialism that occurred at the site. But there's no evidence that you got like a big village anywhere nearby. So most people with Ohio Hope World are living some distance from the earthworks in relatively small groups of people.
Hamlets.
Yeah. Yeah. I call it. Yeah. So you're talking like a household or two or maybe three or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not anything of immense size. So the biggest, I think the most unique thing, and there are a lot of unique things about the Mansai, but I think the most unique thing is that the site has a very large habitation area adjacent to it. And I think for a long mm-hmm. time, people, you know, various researchers were reluctant to, you know, attribute this to a population of any size. You know, they say, well, you know, it was probably occupied for a long time and, you know, they could revisit the site over a period of time and cluster of people come back over, you know, a couple hundred, a few hundred years or something. You could result in a decent amount of stuff next to the site. And I think that was just because, you know, Ohio Hope Well was that way, where you're not mm-hmm. seeing large habitation areas. But after looking at the results of the magnetometry data, and just the volume of stuff that's on this site, it's absolutely huge. Like I said, mm-hmm. really thousands of features spread over a huge area. And we have just like a partial glimpse at that beneath the surface with the magnetometry data that we collected. But it's, I make an argument in the book and, you know, I get into some detail, but the bottom line is that I have a somewhat hard time believing that this is just a few people coming back here and there, you know, over time. There mm-hmm. had to have been a more substantial population. Now, you know, estimating population, everybody's asked that question, you know, well, what size was the population? You know, that's kind of notoriously difficult to tackle in archaeology. You know, how
absolutely.
Many?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Any given time, what areas were occupied at any given time, how many people lived in a house, you know, you can tweak those numbers up and down as you want. But so I'm saying it's, you know, for lack of a better term, we can call it a village probably safely. And again, mm-hmm. people about what the definition of a village is or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I always thought of it kind of this way. Like if you looked at a Mississippian site, which we know were occupied for very long periods of time. You look at the feature density on some of these sites, you know, with magnetometry data or whatever, you know, it's comparable to that. Now, I'm not claiming that there was 1,000 people there or anything that high, perhaps, but, you know, it's more than just a cluster of a few households. Let's say that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to be too conservative.
Right.
but it was a pretty decent population, let's say. You know, so maybe I had to have people persuade me a little bit, twist my arm a little bit and say like, well, you know, go off the deep end and say it, you know, that there was a decent number of people there and there's pretty good data for it. But I'm pretty confident that that was the case. Now, talking about habitation areas, and I mentioned, you know, mm-hmm. Ohio well-being, you know, these little hamlet type situation. You can find, however, larger habitation areas if you go to the southeast, right? So they're not super common. I mean, there's Kolomoki is one site. The Leek site in Georgia is another possibility. But there are sites that have, let's say, platform mounds quite often with a decent large habitation area adjacent to it. So it's not like totally unprecedented. You know, it's not, you can't find this mm-hmm. anywhere else, but do find it in the southeast, which is just another, you know, kind of oddball thing with Mansai. It just
connection.
Yeah. It's kind of odd connection to this whole Southeastern Hopewell tradition. But yeah, so there's a lot of people there. And I don't know. Well, I can tell you this too, that we've got a number of radiocarbon dates from the habitation areas mm-hmm. we didn't really have before this occurred. And what we were finding with the radiocarbon dates is they were spanning the entire length of the occupation from 200 to 600. CE. So mm-hmm. it appears that the habitation area kind of existed hand in hand with the creation and use of the mounds. So like something that happened halfway through perhaps or anything like that. We're seeing this is part and parcel of the mound construction in use is the habitation area.
I think for me, what was so interesting to read about this, read that specific chapter, is the reading that I have done on the Hopewell, just the thing that's most intriguing about them is this kind of wide dispersal population-wise, or at least habitation-wise, this wide dispersal, and then these absolutely massive geometric earthwork ceremonial sites, and that mold seems to be remixed or just molded into something super unique. There's not really any other way to put it. It's kind of its own thing, just kind of as we're talking about it.
It's
Hopewell. Yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of the argument I'm making in the book, is it is its own mm-hmm. unique thing. It takes elements from particularly Ohio, the Southeast, and sort of mixes them together in mm-hmm. something that's not either one 100%, but it's mm-hmm. its own beast. The man face,
right? It almost feels like it should be, because it seems like it is Hopewell, but it kind of is a little bit of a misleads you to think that it's might be more like the Hopewell than it actually is. I mean, there are obviously a lot of similarities, but mm-hmm. Do you think there could be a case made for its own kind of unique label, kind of apart from Hopewell?
I mean, you know, if you look at the artifacts that you're finding at these sites, they're typical Hopewell stuff. You know, you got your Hopewell sun pottery, you've got lots of lamellar blades, you've got, you know, copper ear spools, and, you know, all the things that you would expect to find at a Hopewell site, but the sort of blending together is the unique thing. Another thing to point out too, when you talk about the habitation area, that the man site is the only large habitation area that we know of for man face. Mm-hmm. The rest of the man face people are kind of living in smaller settlements, maybe similar to what you might find in Illinois or Ohio or something like that. So it's not like there's other large settlements in the area. So it's mm-hmm. for whatever reason, a fairly decent number of people decided to congregate at the man site proper. Only.
Yeah, I have a question about that. But before I get to that, I did want to ask you, so there's a discussion about in the book about whether or not you thought that the man site may have been occupied seasonally or annually or some sort of, or if they were permanently sedentary kind of year round. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, because obviously there's a lot of different possibilities. So I'm curious what your thoughts are.
You know, that's one of the questions that I wasn't able to answer with any great certainty, let's say. I mean, you know, your best data to answer those sorts of questions would be things like faunal and floral information, you know, animal bones and seeds and that sort of thing, and what sort of information that could give you about when the site was occupied. And unfortunately, there's been, especially with the faunal data, there's really hasn't been a heck of a lot done. Just a few you know, remarks here and there about the types of animal remains that are on the site. There's a little bit more information from man face flora, and you've got a lot of your Eastern agricultural complex plants, particularly maygrass and goosefoot. But, you know, you're kind of looking for these plants that could only be used at this time. And there's some indications that maybe they were the site was being occupied year round, but it's desperately needed, you know, more information on that question. You know, I wish I could answer it better, but it's, you know, there's always more to do. You know, there's no archaeologist said, you know, we've wrapped it up. We know everything. So we don't need to do any more research on this topic. Yeah.
So you did mention that there are other man face sites that are kind of in that area. It's not a huge dispersal. I think there's like 5 counties that have man face associated sites.
Yeah.
Is it possible that those sites that are kind of in that area may have gathered together at this the man site itself, and then kind of dispersed throughout? Or is that a model you don't really see making much sense?
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's it's obvious that this is the, you know, the biggest site in the whole region. I mean, it certainly would be one of those places where people would gather for various ceremonies and then kind of, like I said, disperse out to the back to their little hamlets and what have you afterwards. But yeah, I mean, geographically, it's very circumscribed. You know, it's just south,
right,
West Indiana. We don't know a lot about man-faced sites, perhaps in adjacent areas in Illinois and Kentucky. There's some suggestion that there might be similar stuff over there, but there just hasn't been a lot of work done there. But yeah, we've identified a lot of sites that they're over the years. A lot of them are confined to two counties, really, only just Posey and Vandenberg counties in extreme, you know, southwestern Indiana. And then there's a smattering of other sites adjacent to that. But it doesn't have a wide, you know, geographic distribution.
Which, I don't know, would that kind of reflect this might be an incorrect word to use, but cosmopolitan, like, core, or there's a, just the man phase was really just describes this kind of central site, and that the kind of surrounding areas kind of looked.
I mean, the site was definitely cosmopolitan, you know. I mean, we'll get into this a little bit later, but when you look at the artifacts from there, you're seeing stuff from all over the place.
Yeah.
And some suggestion that maybe people from other areas were living at the man site or adjacent to it. So not only are you just getting the stuff, right, the raw materials or finished artifacts from other places, there's some suggestions you're actually getting the people as well, which is pretty interesting, I think. It was a very cosmopolitan site at a time when, you know, like I said, the Illinois Hopewell is kind of waning. And maybe getting towards the tail end, maybe, of the Ohio Hopewell phenomenon and extending even past that. So, you know, maybe after Ohio Hopewell was done, man was like the biggest thing in this whole area as far as, like, you know, level of importance and, you know, the, I don't know, you might say exciting things that were happening there.
History isn't just in the books, it's in the soil, the stones, and the stories of your region. Join ARI's regional archaeological tours and explore hidden sites, historic landscapes, and the places where history happened, led by real archaeologists filled with real discoveries. See the land like you've never seen it before. Check out our tour dates at exploreari.org.
So I have one last question about the habitation, and then we can move towards the material and kind of that you've been finding. So because the way that the man site is kind of composed, it's so unique, I was wondering what might explain this unusual aggregation of kind of individuals at this site. So I think in your book, I apologize, I don't remember who you quoted, but I think you said that there were like three different explanations for why this might have happened, which was climate, maybe some sort of violence that was going on politically, or possibly some sort of religious or ceremonial kind of compulsion to get to the site. Of those three things, and if there's another one that I've forgotten, please let me know. But I mean, what do you think kind of explains? Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the draws of the area was the environmental. I mean, you know, there's these shallow lakes in the area. The Ohio River is nearby. There's a lot of, you know, ecological variability in the immediate area. So, you know, it's a pretty decent spot for resources for people where hunting and gathering is still a component of their diet and, you know, making up an unknown percentage, let's say, of their diet. So that was definitely part of it. But I don't know that it's the only, I don't know if we can explain man solely based upon that. It's not like so much better than some other spot, you know, up the river. And, you know, it was like, obviously, this is the best spot on the landscape, right? You know, I think that it had to have been something more of a religious nature, long-term, important place where important things were happening that draws people and draws attention. It draws trade goods. I mean, you know, it's definitely not a violence related thing. There's really no evidence for that. You know, the habitation area just kind of spread out all over the place without any kind of evidence for a palisade wall or anything like that, that would suggest that people were, you know, had any worries about, being attacked or anything. They see much evidence for any type of concern there. But yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like sometimes that this is like a default explanation, but I, you know, I think it was an important place spiritually, you know, for some sort of religious significance. You know, what exactly may have happened at that site to make it an important spot? Mm-hmm. You know, we'll probably never know. Those are the sorts of things that it, you know, can be virtually impossible to know, you know, based upon the evidence right. we can find in the ground. But, you know, I have the kind of hunch, let's say, more than that, you know, the data are there that would suggest that this is a very important spiritual place that was used for hundreds of years through, you know, AD 600 or so. And something happened at that point where people decided they didn't care to do it anymore. And then that was the end of it.
It's interesting, and maybe this is a bad comparison, but I think just in that kind of religious motivation for people to kind of move into the, or at least aggregate this site, it's just interesting because I talked with Dr. Pakatat, Dr. Timothy sure. Pakatat, last month about Cahokia, right. and that Cahokia's start is definitely associated with some sort of religious movement that people or religious project that people bought into and mm-hmm. came.
There's any other explanation.
At least live in this hinterland. Yeah.
A lot of sense as far mm-hmm. as Cahokia is concerned. I mean, why that's, right. why did people flock to this site in huge numbers? I mean, there doesn't seem to be much other, you know, reason. There was some important person or some important event, so the religious thing that happened there that we may not be able to nail down precisely. And I think probably a similar thing might have been happening, perhaps on a smaller scale, of course, but happening with respect to the man site.
Because it is such an outlier in the context of the Hopewell world. Is that something that you would want to try and explain in future research about maybe the size and the at least the existence of these habitation spaces?
Yeah, I don't have any immediate plans to do any excavations there. Although, of course, you know, with any book there, you got to draw borders as to what you're going to cover. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't answered every question that I could possibly answer with the materials that that we have. And like I said, one of the things being that we don't know much about, you know, animal remains or plant remains from the site. Mm-hmm. Those are some things that we could possibly do in the future to answer some of those.
Right.
lingering questions that we have about the site. So I always got some gears turning in my head, like, oh, maybe I could do this or maybe I could do that. But, you know, in the midst of all
it's an exciting place to be. Yeah.
Of my other projects that I got going on, it's
right. So just to kind of wrap up our discussion about the habitation, so you've already kind of used this word to describe it, but I had a question written just if we could safely describe Mansite as a village. And I guess if it is a village, then it would be one of the only Hopewell villages that we have kind of in the archaeological record.
Yeah, well, certainly they're the only one in this neck of the woods. Like I said, you can go right. to the east and you can find things that are probably comparable, but there's not many of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a right. few candidates. So it's not by no means common to find these sorts of things in the southeast. But yeah, you're not going to find anything comparable at this time period, at least in the Midwest.
Right. So just kind of moving more towards the materials and the nature of the artifacts that you have found at the Man site. A lot of them are made from materials that come from areas that are not local. So what do these kind of items tell you about the networks and kinds of connections that the Man site or the Man phase people had across Eastern America? Let's say.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they had connections all over the place, it would seem. I mean, like, mm-hmm. see, with a lot of Hopewell stuff, there's pretty broad mm-hmm. network of trade during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
There's some interesting, somewhat unique things that you perhaps wouldn't find with Ohio Hopewell. Mm-hmm. One of the things you're finding a fair amount of is Tallahatta quartzite, which comes from Alabama. There's, of course, mica, which you do find at Hopewell sites from the Appalachians, lots of quartz mm-hmm. crystal from the Appalachian areas, copper, silver from up around the Great Lakes, obsidian at the site. Mm-hmm. And the unique thing about the obsidian from the Man site is that it comes from about 90% of it comes from Bear Gulch source, which is basically it's in Idaho. And mm-hmm. it contrasts sharply with the profile of obsidian from Ohio Hopewell, which is 90% obsidian cliff, right, from Wyoming.
Right.
They get about 10% Bear Gulch, and it's kind of flipped at Bansite. So there's something different going on there with the trade networks, perhaps.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't have a fantastic explanation for it, but it's certainly worth noting that, you know, that they're got, they're sourcing their material from different areas. I mean, the same with Illinois Hopewell stuff. About, I think about 70% or so of the Hopewell obsidian from Illinois is obsidian cliff. So man's this kind of little area where they're for some reason have a lot of Bear Gulch stuff. So yeah,
I well, it makes you wonder like where other Bear Gulch obsidian pops up in the material record. Do you know of any other sites?
I mean, in this area, you know, it's there's some here and there, but like I said, it's kind of in the minority no matter where you look. I haven't looked out farther west to see where it pops up, but yeah, it's unique enough here. I mean, to talk about, you know, connections to Ohio specifically, there's Flint Ridge chert in pretty decent quantities at Mansite. So there, that does show a connection to Ohio. But in terms of like direct connection, if you, you know, if you were looking for Ohio Hopewell pottery at the Mansite, I haven't seen anything that it, that I'm certain came from Ohio. But I am certain, and I'm not the only one, that there's pottery coming from the southeast, right? There's this real sandy stuff, simple stamped sandy stuff that, you know, those who know this better than I do have said that, you know, it probably comes from like Georgia or something like that, which wouldn't be surprising because that's, you know, you're probably close to like the mica and quartz crystal source areas. And so that might be sort of part of that whole exchange network.
And you mentioned that there may have, there was some evidence to suggest that you might have had visitors coming from other places and they may have stayed at the Mansite. So is that what you're talking about? This pottery, is that the kind of evidence for that?
Yeah. I mean, you've got a decent amount of this stuff, this sand tempered stuff that looks a lot different from what you, the local material is. But the argument more hinges on the complicated stamp pottery that you find at the site. And it's probably the thing that the Mansite is most well known for. You know, if you're going to ask anybody, you know, off the top of their head, an archaeologist, let's say, what they know about the Mansite, you know, the complicated stamp pottery there, which doesn't belong in Southwest Indiana. It's, you know, it's a Southeastern thing, Swift Creek type pottery. But previous analyses of this complicated stamp stuff shows that the vast majority of it is locally made, right? It's not, they're not imports from, let's say, Georgia. Some of the stuff, you know, I've looked at some of the stuff and it does not look local. It's got sand temper in it. It's got attributes that I'm pretty sure probably did come from Georgia or somewhere in that area at least. But the vast majority of that complicated stamp stuff is locally made. And it's not some clumsy, you know, imitation of Swift Creek stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it looks the same, but they're using different tempers. You know, our man face stuff is tempered with grog or limestone, and it's just temper different clays than what you would find in the southeast. So somebody's actually there making complicated stamp pottery. As far as we can tell, it's like identical to the southeastern stuff.
Wow.
Temper. Right. Now, why the heck they changed the temper, I honestly don't know. But convenient for us, because we can tell now that fairly readily that it's the locally made stuff without, you know, some kind of petrographic analysis. You just look at the temper and you can see that it's probably locally made. So, you know, and it's not super abundant. It's not like you're getting 30% of it. You know, let's say around 3% or so is complicated stamp stuff, and it's spread over the whole site. So there's not like a, you know, for lack of a better term, a neighborhood where complicated stamp stuff is overwhelmingly found. At least that's what Charlie Laser said, and he visited the site 500 times. So I kind of take his word for it.
Right.
but yeah, it's kind of spread all over the place. And you find it also at outlying sites. So it's not just at the Mansite. You find this complicated stamp stuff at the smaller outlying hamlet type sites as well. So it's kind of making its way through most of the people there. You know, it's so distinctive, you can pick it out really easily. So
really,
yeah, it's just one and that, sign of the cosmopolitan nature of the site, one of many.
Right. Well, it makes you wonder, because you said it wasn't a loose kind of interpretation of what that stuff looked like. It was seemed like it was expertly made, just how they would make it down there, which would suggest that there must have been people from that region at Mansay, at least for a portion of time, doing something.
Yeah.
But I guess
the other thing to point out too is that it occurs in early man and it occurs in later man too. So it's not like there's a little blip where you get some people from the southeast that are coming up there and doing their thing, and then they disappear or something. As far as we can tell at this point, this is a long-term relationship, right? Some of the later, we have one site that dates from about 500 to 600 AD, and you're really not finding any complicated stamp stuff there. It may have fallen off by 500 or so, but you know, from 200 to, let's say, 500, it does appear that there's this kind of, like, say, relationship with these Swift Creek people.
Yeah, and so a little bit over the hour mark, so I want to respect your time, but before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you kind of about, so there are different phases of the Man site's history. So could you tell us a little bit about what characterizes distinctively early man from maybe the later man phases or the later man period?
Yeah. I mean, mostly you're getting into kind of little nitty gritty details of the pottery, like this motif is more common or that motif is more common, you know. And I did make some attempt to try to tease those things out. I mean, one of the disadvantages, let's say, of the Man site is the fact that it was occupied for so long. And so you've got, you know, 400 years worth of material being deposited there, and can be a little bit difficult to tease out earlier versus later stuff. But there are some sites that were excavated, like Brett Ruby, for example, excavated the Graybert site, which is a Man phase site to the north of Man site itself. And that one dated to somewhere around 200 to, I think it was about 300 or so. And then there was another site that I was mentioning just a moment ago. It's called Keister, and it dates from 500 to 600. So those two sites, you know, can give us a little bit of a glimpse of the earlier versus late stuff in terms of not only just ceramics, but, you know, chert frequencies and stone tool type stuff as well. And so that's kind of what I was basing it on, is just some hints of some of the changes that occurred through time. Also, I'll mention this too. At the Man site, there was an excavation, one of Keller's excavations. He dug this huge, it wasn't huge in horizontally, it was deep unit.
I can't, really?
It went down 7 or 8 feet and didn't even reach the bottom.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, back when you could do those sorts of things, a small unit elevator. But he dug this thing like 8 feet down. And so he did get a stratified deposit from Man that does show some changes in temper frequencies and stuff like that. There's some pretty clear changes in that kind of thing. So there's a little bit of information about, like, changes in ceramics over time from those excavations. But I wish we had more information, as usual. But
right. I was about to say, I think that teasing out the intricacies of how the Man site developed over time would probably require more work to be done at the site itself.
Yeah, certainly.
I did want to ask, just kind of as a wrap-up question. So around 600 AD, as you said, evidence that the site was inhabited kind of seems to taper off. Is there any kind of hypothesis that you have about why this site ceased to be utilized? I know that there was about 100 years gap between when it, you know, human activity kind of pops up again, but is there kind of a clear example of why that was?
You know, your guess is as good as mine. I don't have a reason why the site's became important in the first place. It's one of these kind of elusive, perhaps, reasons. Something important happened there, a religious event. I mean, something that, and then why it stopped being important, you know, to the people, that they felt like they no longer had maintained the earthworks or live on site, you know, around 600 or so. I don't know for sure, but yes, there is a sort of gap, 100 years, where you know, if there's anybody living in this area, you know, their archaeological signature is rather light. And then you get another called Yankee Town picking up around 700 or so. And it looks right. way different in terms of the ceramics and stone tools and all that kind of thing. So, you know, material. I can't make any great connection between the two, that there's like this kind of ancestor descendant type relationship between man and Yankee Town, that one became the other one. I can't say that. Kind of hard to make that argument, but.
Okay, so I've just got one more question. It's just kind of regarding what you would just, your work at the Man site. So where would you like to see more research done on this, on the Man phase broadly, but the Man site generally? Mm-hmm. Where would you like people to focus, or where are you planning on focusing in the future?
Oh yeah, always more magnetometry can be done. It's a great, mm-hmm. you know, it's a great way to see what's going on over a broad area without disturbing, you know, and this is a,
yeah,
it's a site where, you know, you don't want to be just kind of willy-nilly digging at it. It's a important site for the ceremonial site. And so we have to be very about what we're excavating and, you know, make sure that we're, you know, kind of consulting with the tribes and that sort of thing. So I don't have any immediate plans to do any digging at the site. And in fact, there's a lot that's already been excavated that really can be analyzed in the present day to answer some of those questions. You know, for example, there's still some material that hasn't been cataloged and like that deserves to be looked at. And some of the animal, as I was saying before, that are in collections that could certainly be looked at by somebody and have some information derived from that. So at this point in time, you know, I foresee sort of smaller projects to kind of add a little bit here and there, you know, to our the site. But I mean, you know, the major reason I wrote this book in the first place was just to sort of bring attention to the site. And 25 years, more than that, since the last major thing was written on Man, it was Brett Ruby's dissertation. Mm-hmm. He kind of compiled all the information that was written up to that point in time. And he wasn't able to get on the site at that time either. That one was still off. And so he compiled everything he could at that time, and he did a great job of it. Don't get me wrong. You know, in 25 years, we've learned a lot more. We had more collections to look at. We had a lot more carbon dates. So there was just a few smattering of carbon dates back then. There was a lot more to say and kind of update the picture as to what was going on there and kind of add to what he had already done. And that's, you know, that was the, and I just wanted to bring it more to a broader audience and say like, hey, everybody up this site, you know, most people have heard of it and make perhaps reference to it. And, you know, oh, by the way, there's this Man site here in Indiana as well. But, you know, they didn't really have much to say about it because not a heck of a lot had been published, you know, in terms of detail, especially. So there were perhaps a lot of misconceptions on people's parts as to what the site was about or when it occurred and that sort of thing. And I just thought it was time to let people know what this site's all about and sort of bring it to the broader audience. So I hope I've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want more people to know about the Man site because it's super interesting. I've been talking to my friends about it. They also think it's really interesting as well.
Yeah.
But Dr. Strzyzewski, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. So
thank you. You're quite welcome.